This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Well, there's a lot we don't know about adults with autism in Bexar County, but it's clear that there are thousands of adults in Bexar County with autism spectrum disorder or intellectual and developmental disabilities who do not have access to services. A recent study estimates 21,600 adults in Bexar County have autism or intellectual disabilities, and only 10% were receiving those services. So what are the barriers for matching the people who have the need for the services and the service providers? What is available here in Bexar County? Do you have a story to tell us about dealing with autism? Call in the questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8988. 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this afternoon with Kara McGrain. She is the Executive Director of Autism Lifeline Links. Dr. Jessica Graber, she is a Clinical Director of Outpatient and Educational Services at the Autism Treatment Center. And Jacob Yolinski is the Director of Intellectual and Developmental Disability Services at the Alamo Area Council of Governments, ACOG. Again, the number is 210-614-8980. If you have an adult dealing with who has been diagnosed with autism in your life, if you've got questions about how can you get them services, how can you help them access group homes or have some social engagement, call in. We'll have some answers for you, 210-614-8980. So Kara McGrain, Executive Director of Autism Lifeline Links, you were part of this first-of-its-kind study here in Bexar County. What were you looking for and what did you find?
Thank you for having us today. Autism Lifeline Links is a project out of the Kronkowski Charitable Foundation. We launched back in October 2016, as a way to try to decrease wait times, increase services array for anyone on the spectrum in our community. And we've done a great job over the past 2 years of really identifying and breaking down the isolation for children with autism in our community and the families who care for them. But we've really been struggling with how to identify those adults with autism. They're generally a population that's been disenfranchised, maybe definitely underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed, and have not generally had many services. So the foundation, the Kronkowski Charitable Foundation, who we're out of and is our benefactor, went ahead and contracted with CI Now, Dr. Laura McCarron, to do this study. So we really could better understand what the numbers really are and what is the cost to us as a community financially for annual cost or lifetime cost of care for this population. Really to have a rally cry around taking steps to vigorously work to identify these people in our community. And we know the gaps are great in the service array, but if we don't have a good understanding of how many people are out there and what their level of need is, we're really going to be challenged even further to meet the services.
So as we talk about adults who are on the autism spectrum, what does that actually mean? It's a big spectrum, and they say when you meet one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. It's going to vary from individual to individual. No two are alike. So Dr. Jessica Graber, if you could talk a little bit about what is the condition and what are the symptoms? How is it exhibited?
Absolutely. Autism is really defined by two characteristic features, and those are related to social and communication difficulties and differences and restricted and repetitive interests or behaviors. And so depending on where you fall on that spectrum, those two characteristics can present various ways. Just like you said, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. About a third of individuals with autism also have intellectual disability. About a third of individuals with autism have very limited communication as well, and including what we typically call nonverbal. And so really it can present a variety of ways. There are some individuals who are very high on that functioning spectrum, and those individuals can have some really exceptional skills and abilities that are unique. I often think of autism as really a personality difference that in an extreme manifestation or on that that far end of that spectrum can be clinically significant and very challenging for the individual. But really there are several traits that are consistent with autism that are normally distributed throughout the population.
And when we're looking at this study, and we're talking about mainly individuals who are possibly nonverbal, or they are not really social, and typically they're homebound, and they're being cared for by family, and they really don't have many opportunities to socialize, and there's questions about whether or not they're receiving what the proper care, the treatment, the medical care, the dental care, all the other things. The family's doing the best they can, but maybe if they were receiving services and guidance and supervision, that there could be an improvement to the quality of life for the individual that they love.
That's exactly right. So there have been huge improvements in public service delivery and in education in particular since the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And so individuals who are on the autism spectrum, whether or not they're diagnosed as such in their 40s and above, but even in their 30s, some of those individuals have received really subpar services relative to what kids today are receiving. And we still have so far to go. And one of the biggest things we know about autism is that early intervention in the form of maximizing social interactions and normalization in education, so mainstreaming, all of those things are relatively new developments, and individuals in their 40s and up really didn't benefit from those services.
So when you say mainstreaming, is that we don't want to have this segregation of people who have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and that they have to live separate and apart from our society. They are part of our society, and they are part of our families, and we should be able to embrace them as a community?
Absolutely. The kind of diversity that we see in all of us, and then especially for individuals on the autism spectrum, can add, they have so many strengths and so many things that they can contribute to the community, but it's only been recently that we've really understood that kind of difference and been able to maximize outcomes. So the things that really seem to matter in terms of prognosis or level of later independence are things like extent to which the individual is mainstreamed from an early age, early intervention, even before school age, so even before 6 years old. Those kinds of things really matter a lot.
So this is not something that if a person who is an adult with autism and maybe they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, this is not really a good idea to begin now. Or what do you think?
I think actually what we've seen is individuals who are 30 years and older, we see a decrease in terms of some of the symptoms of autism if they're given supports and inclusion and given opportunities to work. We've actually seen a lot of progress in that age group when given the opportunity.
Right. So the opportunity to work, opportunity to find a level of independence. These are all things that every individual values, including people who are on the spectrum. We're talking about adult autism and services that are available in Bexar County. There is this vast service gap between people who deserve services, need services, should be able to access services, and being able to get them to those individuals. And why that is, what's out there. We're going to talk more about available services in Bexar County when we come back from this break. The number to call in, join our conversation. We really want to hear from you. 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about adult autism this afternoon and the service gaps here in Bexar County. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Ben is on the line. Hi, Ben. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Thanks for calling in.
Well, I just thought I'd call in, tell my story. I was diagnosed when I was about 18 years old. You know, prior to that, I thought I was operating with a turbocharged case of ADHD. You know, I've always taken medication for it, therapy, things like that. And I find that things really picked up when I had accommodations and a bunch of help in high school and in college. But to get that, my mom actually had to fight tooth and nail for it. You know, of course, we see in the news that there are arbitrary caps put on the level of services available to kids on the spectrum, and that does have an impact when we grow up. I mean, I think I've read somewhere that people on the spectrum have a 90% unemployment rate. And I'm lucky. I'm one of the high-functioning cases. You know, I was diagnosed with what you have, what's called Asperger's, until it got rolled into the umbrella by the APA. And, you know, the services available for us as adults, I'll be honest with you, it's severely lacking. The only work I've been able to get, you know, has just been me going out there and getting it for myself. Less of my, you know, depending on, you know, vocational rehab or what used to be called DARS, I just got shuffled around between temp agencies and, you know, little part-time jobs. It's not sustainable.
Ben, thank you so much for your call. You bring a lot to the table. I'm so glad you're able to join us for that. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, folks like Ben who are Asperger's or Aspies, and they are on the spectrum, but they are higher functioning, but still they need services. They deserve services. What's available for people like Ben? Let me go to Jacob Ulinski. He's with the Alamo Area Council of Governments, Director of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Services.
Absolutely. So there are a number of services that are available here in Bexar County for individuals with autism and intellectual and developmental disabilities. And what most folks will hear or may recognize is the term waiver or Medicaid waiver program. And so here in Bexar County, we have over 6,000 individuals that are on interest lists for these Medicaid waiver programs in order to access services for individuals that have these types of special needs.
And so, but there are there organizations, there are nonprofits here in Bexar County who will do things like help people get jobs or get job training. There's also social opportunities. Karen McGrain with the Autism Lifeline Links.
So the waivers can help with the employment part of the deal, but there are some amazing organizations. Asperger's 101 is an organization here in town, and they have a remarkable website for guys like Ben who can go and navigate that, support groups, blogs, all that kind of stuff that helps with that social networking. There are also a few meetup groups, which are, you know, a bunch of guys with Asperger's hanging out at a coffee shop, or even lower functioning populations that have meetup groups that are on the spectrum. So those are two really neat places to start, as well as the Autism Society website and Autism Speaks websites. Both of those have links to local chapters of supports or places to go or to navigate where they could get some help.
So I know that the San Antonio Clubhouse has been very helpful with people who have been dealing with recovery from mental issues. Is that something also that applies?
Yep. So Clubhouse, they're Mark Stolte, that group, they're wonderful over there. And we estimate, we've met with them a few times, and I believe they estimate that about a third of their population that currently uses the Clubhouse also is on the spectrum. And so it is the primary diagnosis to use the Clubhouse needs to be a mental health diagnosis, but a lot of the comorbid diagnoses happen. So we've been having those conversations with them.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines with Stephanie. Stephanie, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry, we lost you. Call back, Stephanie, and we'll try and get you back on the air. Here's Aldo. Aldo, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. And I'm listening to these organizations and associations that y'all are talking about, and they're great ideas. And I would just like to put out there for anybody who would like to come or is interested in playing tennis or already plays tennis, mm-hmm. there is a big social club in San Antonio. It's called Tennis Club of San Antonio, or TCSA. You can look it up on Facebook. There's a lot of people that have, you know, never even played tennis and, you know, started to play and learn through our club. You know, so I would think that that's a healthy alternative and, you know, can also help people socialize and build that ever so important network of people around them.
Thank you for that call, Aldo. So Dr. Jessica Graber with the Autism Treatment Center, how important is physical activity for individuals who are trying to come up with better ways to manage their anxieties and things?
Physical activity is so important for all of us, and individuals on the autism spectrum are at risk for a variety of comorbid is sometimes what it's called, difficulties related to their health and physical and mental health. And so I would think of physical activity as being a huge preventative factor, and especially for the socialization too. I love that Aldo talks about the social club and if you're interested in tennis, because what I said earlier, they're the two parts of autism, the restricted repetitive interests or very strong interests. And so a great way for individuals on the spectrum to make friends and to meet people that they can form relationships with, another huge protective factor, is by, you know, Googling social clubs for particular interests in your area.
Another caller. Stephanie has returned. Stephanie, welcome back. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just calling to know what they're doing to educate the business community. We had a young man who had his PhD. Asperger's are very high functioning. He had his PhD in entomology and spiders and bugs. But he had a hard time getting a job because he had to go through the personal interview, and he had socialization problems. Eventually got a job with a pest control, but his supervisor was uncomfortable with his disability and did not want to work with him. And actually, I felt like it was a case where you could, you know, take him to the employment agency or whatever.
All right.
But the businesses need to be trained.
Stephanie, thank you for the call. So Karen McGrain with Autism Lifeline Links.
So there's a remarkable new program under the leadership of Sean Kennedy's chairmanship at the San Antonio Chamber of Commerce this past year. It's called Project Ability, and it was launched just a few months ago with the guise of doing exactly what she's saying, educating the employment, educating on the benefits of employment, because as Dr. Graber said, this is a population who is loyal, attention to detail, they're not going to miss work, they're not going to have a mental health day when we all want to just not wake up and go, because their regiment, their routine, their dedication and commitment is very, very high as compared to the neurotypical space. So the Project Ability, you can go to the San Antonio Chamber of Commerce website and look that up. I know they're looking for committee members and groups to make sure that we're spreading the word. We have some great employers already in this community, HEB being one of them, but we need to educate, we need to open up that circle and educate more and more people that on how you employ somebody, how you interview them. The interview style is very different. How you communicate with them, how you discipline them, or anything like that. So we're getting there. It's a slow conversation, but we are absolutely getting there.
But there's a tremendous amount of training that's available for individuals who want to go into these programs. They can be trained on how to maintain copiers and mm-hmm. keep everything functioning in an office space. They can share work days with multiple offices. They manage the VIA system. They're able to get around. This is a resource that a lot of companies in San Antonio are wondering who they need someone to do things around their office. But this is a resource that they could actually come and provide important services to help the workplace flow. And where would be a good place for someone to reach out to figure out where would I make that connection?
So, and that's a great segue for our forum. We're having a forum tomorrow that was launched after this, after the study was released, to really have a conversation that is specific to the adult population and the things, the challenges they have: employment, housing, socialization. So, if somebody has a resource, the Tennis Connect that Aldo said, go to the Autism Lifeline Links website and hit the contact us link and populate the information in there, and we can get that out to people and or invite them to future forums. So there are so many great little pockets of things that are happening for the adult autism population. The challenge for the adult autism population and its providers are that they're very siloed. They're not communicating, and that's what the Collective Impact Project of Autism Lifeline Links is supposed to be doing, is bringing them all together so we're communicating, breaking down the silos, so we can have a better understanding of how we expeditiously connect families or adults with services, and then really understand where the gaps are so we can start to fill those.
And so the forum is when? Tomorrow?
The forum's tomorrow, and unfortunately it's full, but which is a good sign. We have a lot of people coming. We're struggling to get more of the group homes and the dayhabs to come and be a part of that, because when people are connected with services, they're connected usually in one of those two pods. So there will be future forums.
So the prevalence of autism, is it increasing? What is happening? Is it just because we're detecting it more, we're looking it out for more, now we have a diagnosis? So Dr. Graber, what can you tell us?
The vast majority of the increase in prevalence is attributable to our increased understanding of autism and our changes in the diagnostic criteria that have occurred. So by and large, I would say more than 95% of that increase can be attributed to that. There are some studies to suggest the extent to which that increase has occurred cannot be entirely attributable to just those diagnostic changes and our increased understanding. So maybe a small percentage of that is related to something environmental. And it's not, there's a lot of research looking into that. And there are lots of things that have changed over the years in our environment. So it's difficult to, isolate what those interactions might be. But there's been some research looking into autoimmune activity in utero, and that might play a role for individuals who are already genetically more predisposed to developing autism. But yes, by and large, it's attributable to changing diagnostic criteria and increased understanding.
So we're looking for it, and we have... and we want to provide for it. But some people think that it's more prevalent in men than in women. But I wonder if it's because it presents itself differently in gender. And also there's expectations different as well.
Yes, all of that is true. Based on our current understanding and description of autism, we do seem to identify males more often as being on the spectrum. But there is evidence to suggest that autism presents differently in females. And just like you were suggesting, that females from a young age are expected to develop social skills, maybe with more emphasis on that than males receive early on. And so females may develop more compensatory skills because of societal pressure to do so. It's important to think about that difference, because it does seem like maybe we're just not capturing how autism manifests for females. And there are some increased risks that females who have autism they have some increased risks related to, we're talking about adults. Adult women who have autism are even more likely to be fired from their jobs.
And also more likely to be sexually assaulted, because
yes,
they
absolutely
are slow to pick up on social cues and may not, and they find themselves in situations where they're, suddenly in a situation where they weren't prepared for. And so you got to wonder about preparation and training that needs to go into that as well. We're talking about adult autism and the air this afternoon. We invite you into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about adult autism in Bexar County. We know that we have a population here in Bexar County, a high number of adults with autism who are not receiving services that they're entitled to having. These are services that can make a big difference in the quality of their life. There are many families that care for a loved one who have an adult with autism. They have to be wondering, who's going to take care of this loved one if something happens to the major caregiver in the family? What can we do to encourage this adult with autism to become more independent, to engage in the community, maybe even go into a group home? Or what are the possibilities? What are the opportunities? At least consider them, because this is how we can improve the quality of life for many individuals. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Let's go to Denise on the line. Hi, Denise. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a 29-year-old adult daughter with autism who also has a mental illness as well. And I just wanted to stress as much as I could, I'm also a retired educator, and I have often thought, if I had not been in education, would I have known how to do some of the things that I was
able to do for my daughter. And she was diagnosed at the age of 3 with pervasive developmental disorder because I pushed the issue so much with the public school. And my daughter's name is Julia, and some of the services that she has right now is because she's been on the list when she was 10 years old. So Texas Home Living class, a class waiver. Julia also has the STAR Plus waiver, and has just recently been able to go and move into a group home where their lives are so orchestrated for them socially and otherwise, like doing chores and the interaction with liked people like her. And it became more and more hard for us, difficult for us to do at home because we can't live in this vacuum. And a lot of time I found at home when I would have her volunteer, or I would take her to daycare, day had, a lot of times I would get there and she'd slept the entire day. And that was not what we wanted for her. And so it was hard to extremely hard for us as her needs became greater for us to do this at our home. And it's a fear of many a parent that have children with disabilities. You wonder what's going to happen to them when you're gone. And we are very fortunate to, most recently, like I have said, to find a place in Austin, out of Austin, and Julia's flourishing and doing really well. So I can't stress enough of identifying your child as early as you can and to get out there and look for services for them because it's so valuable down the road.
Denise, thank you so much for your call. Let me go to Kara McGrain, Executive Director of Autism Lifeline Links, and we'll go hear from ACOG. But
first of all, Denise, thank you so much for calling in. And we have this conversation very often in the space that not every child has a rock star mom like you who was able to navigate that space for you and for Julia. So we're glad she's thriving. But hearing it from a parent who has a child that's older in age, to remind those parents of younger children to advocate, to get on the waiver and interest list, because those interest lists are 15 years long, and they could grow, obviously, because no slots have been released in a number of years. But everything you're saying is a beautiful message for the younger parents of children on the spectrum today. And I think that we can speak, Dr. Graber said earlier, we're getting much, much better than we were when Julia was little, but we still have a very long way to go. But I'd like to toss it to Jacob to talk a little bit about the waivers and the wait list and how people access those and how imperative it is that they get on those lists.
Right, because I got to tell you, you lost me. I mean, you got a 10-year-long wait list. What does that mean, Jacob Ulinski with the Alamo Area Council of Governments?
And so we hear stories like Denise's every day with families that have really struggled to connect with services. And so it is very important for folks to reach out as soon as possible and raise their hand and connect with the front door at ACOG in order to get on those Medicaid interest lists, as well as apply for eligibility determination. And that eligibility determination process is essentially a psychological evaluation with an IQ assessment and adaptive behavior assessment in order to qualify the individual for publicly funded services.
What about making sure if you have a loved one who is on the spectrum and needs a lot of care, and do you have to make sure that they do things, have a Social Security number, get a Texas ID, do all these things? When does all that become like you have to take care of that?
Absolutely. So it's super important to take care of those items and getting those important pieces of documentation as early as possible. It's much easier to get a state ID when the individual is young, when they're a minor, and then they have that for the rest of their life, rather than trying to go through the additional hoops to obtain that documentation later on. Because there's a lot of additional documentation that's required if you don't have that Social Security number, that state ID from the get-go, and it makes it very difficult to access services.
When do you become, like, is an adult with autism and the guardianship issue, when does that become, like, something that needs to be dealt with?
So I was just going to say that amazing program. There are some wonderful individual providers, as well as Catholic Charities, have good programs to help families navigate that guardianship rule. Because so often families put it off because it is time-consuming. It's also emotional.
It's intimidating.
It's intimidating. It's emotional. And so a lot of families put that off, but it's an important step in that adult's individuality. It's an important step in even accessing some of the services. And maybe Jacob can talk more to that.
Do I have to go to probate court and get it?
So, yes. So we have the two probate. And again, we've invited them to the forum to have that conversation so we can break down some of the misunderstandings and some of the miscommunications that happen and let families know how to better access this process and even inform, hopefully, with the conversation, the court system, to let them know how burdensome it is and is there something we can do differently.
So what if a parent or a family member says, well, we don't need to do all that. We're just going to take care of our loved one at home. We have a room and we're going to make sure he's fine and happy and cool and gets all of his favorite treats and there's no worry. We don't need to go through the court because we got it all covered. Why is that a mistake?
If Jacob wants to take
that. Yeah. So that works until the primary caregiver ages out or they decease, and then the rest of the family isn't willing to pick up the slack and helps provide that care. It's also important to consider with guardianship that that is a restriction of the individual's rights. And so there are different alternatives to guardianship, supported decision-making agreements, partial guardianship, and several others that families should consider prior to making that step to really restrict the person's rights and remove their decision-making capacity.
And so you need to do all of that. You need to get the Social Security number. You need to get the state ID. You need to do documentation in order to preserve the rights and the protections for our loved one who has who's been diagnosed. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. We got to take care of this. And what happens, you know, down the road as someone, you make sure if I'm not going to. Because this individual in our family is being taken care of at our home, aren't we saving the state a ton of money? Isn't there a way that we can have some sort of compensation from the state for that?
So absolutely. Through services with ACOG and through the waiver programs, families can receive case management. So it's an individual that's coming to their home to help them plan for the future and plan for what those care needs may be in the future. But there's also an opportunity through the home and community-based services waiver for families or other guardians to provide what's called companion care or foster care for their loved one. So that becomes their job to provide care for the person.
So that individual doesn't have to go to the state school or some of these institutions that the state operates at a high cost, right?
Yes, and that is one of our public policy items for this legislative session. So an average waiver cost is about $52,000 a year, and waivers were developed when we were deinstitutionalizing our state schools or state-supported living centers, and the intent was to give a little bit of cash so the person can remain in their community, and that $50,000 should be able to give them enough of those supports. However, the translated cost is $360,000 for states 1 year of state-supported living. And so when we talk with our legislators and try to educate our families about, we know the interest list and the waiting lists are very long, 15 years at this point, just for our county. However, if we don't get on those lists, we cannot really apply more pressure to our legislators to let them know it's $50,000 now every year, or it's $360,000 when mom is no longer able to care for this child, adult child.
And Dr. Graber, what do we know about the level of care and the quality of care that an individual receives in a loving environment like at home versus a institution?
Having a nurturing, positive environment is so important for development and well-being. Incorporating preferred activities, knowing what those are, giving the individual agency to make choices throughout their life is just so critically important. We all kind of take for granted the extent to which we are making our own choices throughout our days and incorporating our preferences. So certainly loving family members are the best at identifying those things for their family members.
Taking one more break, we'll continue our conversation about adult autism and services that are available here in Bexar County. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Do you have someone in your family, an adult, who has been diagnosed with autism? How are you caring for them? What questions do you have about ways to access services? 210-614-8980. Linda, I see your call. We'll get you on the air right after this break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Adults with autism, our topic this afternoon. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. We have services available in Bexar County. We need to figure out how we can connect people who need the services with the service providers. Linda has called in. And Linda, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is such an important topic. My son is 42 years old. And was diagnosed at age 3 with a language learning disability. And later on, with more testing, he was called MBI for minimal brain injury, because at that time, we didn't have the term autism. I'm a retired educator, and I was very involved in his services. And he received speech and special ed and OT and PT and all those things. Now he's 42 years old. He worked for the same woman for 24 years and was her bookkeeper. He's very good at math. She passed away in May, and now he's moved in with me because he's been unable to get a full-time job. He found a part-time job, but he doesn't interview well because of his speech and language difficulties, and he doesn't read people's faces. He doesn't read senses, emotions. And I need to know what agency would help me, because he doesn't have the identifier of autistic or Asperger's, but he definitely has gaps, and he doesn't qualify for the services so far because I can't prove that he has those needs.
Linda, thank you so much for the call. And let's go to Jacob Ulinski with the Alamo Area Council of Governments.
So I think, Linda, thank you for that question. The best place to reach out would be the Workforce Solutions Alamo. In this past year, they have added a disability navigator that is assisting individuals with navigating the workforce landscape and connecting with employers. And you don't necessarily have to have a specific diagnosis that's as restrictive as the eligibility for public service programs in order to access Workforce Solutions Alamo. So they are really a great resource as far as connecting with employers and connecting individuals with jobs.
So are there navigators available who can help people like Linda who want to be able to get things going with her son, but she doesn't... It's really hard. It's complex. So, Kara, where do they go?
So they go to Autism Lifeline Links. They can go to autismlifelinelinks.org, and if they have an autism diagnosis, they can click the Register Now button. It's in the top banner, and they'll be asked a series of questions about, you know, contact information, where they received their diagnosis, as well as sign an authorization that gives consent for them to be in the Autism Lifeline Links network. Once they do that, once they hit complete, within 24 working hours, a care coordinator, an Autism Lifeline Links care coordinator, calls that family or the individual on the spectrum and starts to create that story, puts all the information in, confirms everything, and then says, what is it that you need? If, for example, they need to go to ACOG because they're not on a waiver or interest list, we can send a referral over to ACOG or give the information to them. If someone is part of our online network, we can send an electronic referral over to that place, and then that receiving agency has the responsibility to contact the person or the parent. So we're trying to, again, expeditiously connect people to resources. But what this helps us do on the backside, David, is when people ask for a service, if it really isn't available, we start to note that on the backside. So we have good data about how many people are on waiver and interest lists, how many people need ABA therapy, how many people are looking for employment. But again, we do not have really great data on the adults because so few adults have registered. We have over 3,000 registrants in the past 2 years. In our website, with over in our platform, with over 5,000 referrals conducted on with all of those families and staffings that happen between 10 different nonprofits. But what we need is for more adults to go to Autism Lifeline Links register, so we can get a better understanding of what the profile of people with autism is in our community, what they need, so we can better understand where the gaps are.
And Dr. Jessica Graber, we heard from Linda talking about her son, and he wasn't ever really diagnosed with autism, mainly because society has had a lot of catching up to do, and so that didn't sync up. But even though now he's adult, he can still get that diagnosis?
Yes. There are providers in the community that do diagnostics for adults. At the Autism Treatment Center, Dr. Rick Chappell actually does our diagnostic assessments for adults. And I talked with him in preparing for this today, and he talked about how over the past 6 months, he's seen a definite increase in the amount of diagnostic referrals he's getting for adults, but still it's just about one a month. So certainly there are resources available for that. And we could have more support in terms of cost. For some people, that might not be cost effective.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got some callers here. Edith. Hi, Edith. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I want to comment. I have personal experience. I do property management. And there was gross neglect of a 24-year-old autistic young man. I had met him. And the person that was getting paid to house him, care for him, or whatever, it was a nut house. It was crazy what was going on over there. Finally, I called Adult Protective, and anybody that wants to help, and I think we all need to help, be prepared to be on hold for a long time, but it's a worthwhile cause. Finally, when I got through and we went through all the steps, the local, you have to be persistent. They just soon wash it, push it away. Are you sure? I said, please, come out. And finally, when they were going to brush me off, I said, listen, if you don't come out, I will call the news media to see what goes on here. This child, young person, lived in a room that reeked of urine. I don't know. He wasn't that way in the beginning. So obviously, there was a lack of care.
Right.
And the room was torn up. The mattress was torn up. There's evidence of the urine even on the wall. Oh. And nobody should be allowed to live like that, especially not when we pay $3,000 a month towards their care.
Edith, thank you for the call. So we have problems with some group homes. What do we do to make sure that group homes are being properly supervised and that the people who live there are being treated well?
So thank you, Edith, and thank you for your advocacy. One of the things that we need to consider is that this is what has led to the disenfranchisement of the adult population, or their parents or caregivers' fearfulness of accessing services. But things again, they are slowly improving. Liken it to the child abuse neglect sector. 20 years ago, it wasn't so great. We're getting better, and the more we educate people to do what Edith did or to be on the lookout for this population, the better off that we really are. And as far as regulation, Edith did exactly what she needed to do, call Adult Protective Services. Many of these group homes have different licensures, and Jacob can speak to the licensure of the group homes. And there are even operations that are not even licensed, David, that are caring for this population because of cost. So once again, the more that we bring all this into the light, have these conferences, have this communication, the more aware we all are as a community.
Okay, and so Jacob Ulinski?
Absolutely. So Edith definitely did the right thing with contacting Adult Protective Services and making that call and being persistent. Unfortunately, in Texas, there are what people generally refer to as group homes that are really boarding homes that are under no licensure whatsoever.
We had a fire at one in San Antonio. Absolutely. Was it 8 years ago? Mm-hmm. When was it four individuals who died? Or it was a terrible tragedy, and it was a group home that was underground. And so this tells you the level, how serious this is.
Absolutely. And so any of the publicly funded services, those agencies are either licensed or contracted directly with Health and Human Services Commission, and they are monitored regularly. They have auditors on site at least once a year that are monitoring the care that the facility is providing. And then they have agencies like Alamo Area Council of Governments, who has our service coordinators or case managers that are out in the community going to on-site visits, making sure that care is being provided appropriately.
So Dr. Jessica Graber with the Autism Treatment Center. So just a little change of focus really quickly. I just wanted to try and talk about how individuals with autism, that people don't realize that they're highly sensitive to light, sensitive to loud noises and weird smells. These are things, and touch. And these are things that we, or people who are neurotypical, may be able to filter out and may not notice or can deal with very well. But when you take individuals who are been diagnosed and are on the spectrum in that environment, it makes it really hard for them to kind of focus and maintain and keep eye contact and do all the things that we want people to do. So should we as a community sort of start realizing that different people react differently in different environments and have more compassion and be able to sort of just make and understand that this person is dealing with a lot?
Yes, it is probably one of the most important takeaways is that increasing compassion and awareness of the differences that individuals experience. And you talked about hypersensitivity to various kinds of sensory input. There's also hyporeactivity. So sometimes individuals with autism have a really high threshold for pain. And so they might be presenting at the doctor not reporting pain to the same way that other people would, and struggling with those.
Right, so they're not just being a baby; they're really mm-hmm. feeling things at a high level, and just being able to calm things down, take your time, have some compassion, and ask what you can do to help this person get through the day. I want to thank all of our guests as we talk about autism, adult autism here in Bexar County. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning us in.